Ida B. Wells was an African-American investigative journalist, abolitionist, and suffragist who led an anti-lynching movement in the United States in the 1890s, founding groups striving for racial justice and being one of the founders of the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. For more on this civil rights icon, we speak with Associate Professor of Africana Studies and Chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, Dr. Gregory Carr. Dr. Carr, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, with great pleasure. Great talking to you again, Janine.
Yes. So, a kind of larger, broader question. Why, in your estimation, would you say the life of Ida B. Wells is important? Not only to American history, but or African-American history, but to women's history as well.
Well, I think Ida Wells is one of the towering intellectuals and activists of the 20th century, really the late 19th through early 20th centuries. And I say that not only as an African woman born and raised in the United States of America, but really on the world stage. She was not only an intellectual of the first rank, and I mean, not only was she a researcher, not only was she, although not formally academically trained, and then there were very few who were at that time. I mean, she did attend college, took some classes at Fisk University in my hometown, Nashville, Tennessee, Lemoyne College, now Lemoyne Owen in Memphis, Tennessee, where she worked as a school teacher in her 20s. So she had some academic training, but she was a formidable researcher, formidable thinker. And she was also in the top tier, if not the leading journalist of her time. And I wouldn't, again, circumscribe that to race. I mean, if we think within Black communities at the time, I would put her in the same conversation as we'll put one of her associates, Timothy Thomas Fortune, who was writing out with the New York Age out of New York. But Ida Wells was, of course, writing in the South. And Ida Wells was a journalist who had a remarkable ability to communicate to a popular audience. She founded the Memphis Free Speech and Headlight, and then wrote for the Headlight newspaper. Ida Wells, her ability to take on the racial terror, American racial terror of the late 19th century in the form of lynching, and then translate the effect of lynching on Black communities for a popular audience made her dangerous to forces of white supremacy, the same ones that attacked and burned her printing facilities, the same ones that I can hear her in my ear now, I imagine, saying they didn't run me out of Memphis because she wanted to come back to Memphis and reestablish. But of course, her friends and associates prevailed upon her not to return to the South. But she was, like I said, first-rate academic, intellectual, first-rate journalist. And then in traveling internationally, going to England, talking about racial terror in the United States and linking it to economics, the political economy of the country, she became a voice outside the country at a time when United States kind of nativism was surging and on the rise. And Ida Wells wasn't afraid to speak truth to power anywhere in the world. And I think that those are just some of the initial reasons I think she's a very important person in the late 19th or the 20th century in liberation struggles, global liberation struggles.
And can you go a little bit deeper into when you were talking about her investigative journalist being a threat to white supremacy? Can you talk a little more about that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. She's born in 1862 in Holly Springs, Mississippi. Her family was decimated by fever, lost her parents. Eventually, a couple of her siblings, she moved with her younger siblings to Memphis, to an aunt's house. And it was in Memphis that she, while a school teacher, began to confront racism. She actually was dismissed from the Memphis School Board in part because of her outspokenness. And she was still in her 20s. She sued a railroad company and won at the district court level for maintaining segregated rail facilities. So she had this predisposition to speak truth to power and to confront injustice. But it was actually, ironically, right around now, in 1892, I guess it was, that one of her friends who had started a grocery store called the People's Grocery in South Memphis, he had been confronted by a white store owner who owned a store across the street, and other whites in Memphis in the wake of an altercation that happened in the store between some children. This brother was confronted by sheriff's deputies and others who actually came, I guess it was March the 5th. And within the space of about 4 days, a white mob in Memphis, commingled between law enforcement and white citizens of Memphis, attacked the People's Grocery, shot and killed the owner and another brother, and destroyed the grocery. And it was really economic reasons. I mean, obviously, the white supremacy is involved as racism, but they were trying to shut down the competition. They wanted to sell to black people in that community. Ida Wells wrote about that very public lynching. It's a form of lynching, mob violence. And when she wrote about it in her newspaper, she said that, you know, black people should just leave Memphis. Let's just leave, because there is no justice for us here. In fact, that is what they say, the dying words of Brother Thomas Moss, who was the brother who had opened the People's Grocery, Ida Wells' friend, had said. And that's really when you see her emerge as a journalist who is concentrating her powers on the issue of lynching. She went on later that year to publish a little book called Southern Horrors, Lynch Law in All Its Phases. Very interesting, because she trained her talents on creating a compendium of descriptions of those who had been lynched in the South. And she, after kind of enumerating lynchings, talks about why people are lynched. And this is where she eviscerates the myth that these white men were, quote unquote, defending white womanhood, which becomes very important because Ida B. Wells was also an advocate for women's suffrage, for the right to vote. But she was not an advocate for white supremacy. So, it's become fashionable now for people talking about the 19th Amendment and women's suffrage to include Ida B. Wells, as well they should. But Ida Wells was very concerned with the race. In fact, she referred to herself as a race woman. So, you know, Ida Wells's whole point in covering lynching, one of the things she said is, you know, they try to say that this is about attacking, defending the honor of white women who are being raped by black men. She said, no. This is about economics. And black women get lynched, too, and black children. This is really about racial terror in the service of economic terror and trying to prevent black collective economic progress. And so, you know, she follows that up with another book. She wrote a book called A Red Record. And she goes back to the early days of Reconstruction in the United States, right after the Civil War. And she goes from 1895 into where she, when she publishes A Red Record, 1865, the end of the Civil War. She takes the 30-year period and she documents all these lynchings in the United States. And she says, you know, people in the country may not realize this, but what you need to understand is the South has been engaged in this high-level race war since the end of the Civil War. The Civil War didn't end it. The Civil War, in fact, in some ways, it has this race war enter a new phase. And the new phase is designed to suppress the black vote. The new phase is designed to suppress black economic progress. And the new phase is designed to create really a neo-slavery. And it's very interesting because Ida Wells, you know, by the time she publishes the second book, A Red Record, she has developed a reputation as being the leading person in the country of any color talking about this issue. And her work around lynching really puts lynching not only in the forefront of issues that black people are struggling to prevent, but it advances a theory of lynching that takes it out of this sexual fantasy tension kind of cultural posture and elevates it to a cold-blooded, clear political economy analysis. And I think that's one of her greatest contributions.
And you were talking about her international reach, because her, yes, her work on lynching took her overseas to Europe on speaking tours about lynching, where she was educating people there about what was going on in the South, to their horror, because many people didn't know what was happening, and even people in the North as well in America.
That's exactly right. She went to Great Britain a couple of times. She went in the early 1890s. 1883, and then she returned following year. And so when she goes, yes, you're absolutely right. She's spreading the message, raising awareness of the racial terror facing African people in the United States. And by doing it in Britain, of course, she's really extending, as I said, not only extending a tradition of doing that, she's linking those earlier movements to internationalize the plight of Africans in this country to the contemporary terrors that she and others were combating in the 1890s and beyond. Of course, the next figure we're going to see emerge in that kind of internationalist phase will be another of her contemporaries, and that would be W.E.B. Du Bois, who in 1900 goes to England and to participate in the first Pan-African Congress, where you see black folk from the Caribbean, from the United States, a handful from Africa, Europe, come together to talk about this notion of building a solidarity movement to combat white supremacy on a global stage. And then, of course, finally, we'll see Ida Wells join with W.E.B. Du Bois and a handful of other black folk in a coalition with white liberals, white progressives in 1908. In 1908, they actually had a race riot in Springfield, Illinois, and that led in 1909 to the formation of a committee which gave birth to the NAACP. And the NAACP is very proud now to include Ida Wells as one of the founding mothers of the NAACP, which is kind of ironic because Ida Wells was always suspicious of white participation, white progressive participation in black causes, in some ways because, like another of her contemporaries, Carter G. Woodson, she was always suspicious of folks having motives that might not always sync with the black liberation struggle motives. So she's a complicated figure, and she often clashed not only with white progressives, but also with other black intellectuals and activists, sometimes around the issue of gender, oftentimes, however, on the issue of action, because Ida Wells, if nothing else, was, I guess at that time, they probably would have called her a militant voice, kind of, you know, an action-oriented intellectual activist. And that didn't always sit right with some of the men, really, in those small elite black circles.
Well, she had clashes with black leaders, but also with women in the movements, that she, like the suffragist movement. She had clashes with the white women that she was organizing with as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's funny when we think about it, there were so many formidable black women who participated in the suffragist movement. I think often when we cluster our analysis of social problems around categories like race or gender, I mean, there's a lot of talk now about intersectionality, race, class, gender. We disaggregate them in ways that don't reflect the lived experiences of the people who engage in social struggle. What do I mean by that? And when Ida Wells is struggling for women to get the right to vote, she's very clear. I want all women to have the right to vote, but I'm struggling first as a black woman. Understanding that, if you go back to the 15th Amendment to the United States Constitution, one of the reasons that Sojourner Truth, a foremother of Ida Wells, raises the issue of her marginalization by some of these white women in this movement to acquire the right to vote. One of the reasons she raises it, because she says, I am black. And so when she gives the famous speech that we have received as Ain't I a Woman, even though she was a New Yorker and probably wouldn't have said ain't, Sojourner Truth is saying, yeah, I'm a woman, but I'm a black woman. And let's be very careful, because what we see in the history of the voting rights struggle in this country is that many of the white women, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, to name two, also had very, even as they were progressive for their time about race, I suppose, in the white community, they still had racism in their analysis. And in fact, it was very popular in the passage of the 15th Amendment to say, you know, these white women struggling for the right to vote, to say, don't give the vote to Sambo, meaning black men, before you give it to your wives and daughters. And so Fred Douglass, who was an advocate for women's rights, is torn because he too is saying, we got to get this right to vote. So yes, black men get the right to vote with the 15th Amendment. Black women do not get the right to vote. However, what you see is black communities exercising the franchise often do so while black women and black men are having conversations before black men go pull the lever. Now it's time for the women's movement to continue as it matures and transitions to the next generation, white women again mounting this effort. We must have the vote. We must have the vote. Ida Wells joins with them, but she's joining with them as a black woman. So in the famous march here in Washington, D.C., during the Woodrow Wilson administration, when you see in just before we get to passage of the 19th Amendment in 1920, what you see is Ida Wells joins in that movement. She joins in that movement, but when she joins in the movement, she does a couple of things. Number one, she's referring to herself as a race woman, meaning we're going to get this right to vote, but as a black woman, I'm doing this for the race, even as I am in a situational solidarity with these white women. And the other thing she refuses to do, she refuses to participate in a segregated march, because the march in Washington, D.C. was segregated by race. One of the ironies that she says, I'm going to expose this hypocrisy. So she refuses to march with the black delegations that are there. She
in the back, right?
In the back, right? They're gonna put the Negroes in the back. Exactly right. And then she moves to the front, say, no, I'm gonna march with my state. See, y'all playing games. And so when you go down to the Museum of American History, there have been over the arc of the last year or so, a number of very powerful displays, also at the Library of Congress. And, you know, shout out to Carla Hayden, the first black person, period, but also a sister who was the Librarian of Congress. You see these stunning pictures of the suffragist movement and these marches. And at the Museum of American History, you see Ida Wells in this march, because Ida Wells is like, I'm not going to march with my sisters who I am with 100%, but they are going to stay in the back. I'm not going to do that. Now, at the same time, that distinguishes her from other titans of the period, like Mary Church Terrell, who is a remarkable, formidable activist, intellectual, organizer, who takes a different tack, a bit of a different tactic. But Ida B. Wells would never be confined to a paradigm where her liberation struggle would be disaggregated in a way that didn't benefit the entire black community. And that's the lesson I think we can learn from today.
And so I want to touch on that point just a little bit more, her refusing to march in the back. Also, when we were talking about her refusing to give her seat in the railroad car, because I think it was a first class car,
yes,
when they were asking her to move. And this is not even, was it even 100? I don't think about 100 years ago. I mean, it's not even that long ago. But
not at all. That's right.
But it was before Rosa Parks. And so.
Oh, no question.
The fact that in the 1890s that she was unwilling to move and that got in a fight with the people trying to remove her, that she had this fight in her that I will not be a second class citizen.
No, absolutely right. You know, it's funny, Harriet Tubman, it's funny when we think about, you know, Jean, it's funny you mentioned this, when we think about how short a time that we're talking about, it's really stunning.
Right.
Let's think about this. Harriet Tubman passes away 1913, which means Harriet Tubman and Ida B. Wells overlap substantially. Mm. The march that we're talking about, the women's march, was March the 3rd, actually, 1913. It's the year Harriet Tubman passes away. So Ida Wells is busting this paradigm at the same time that Harriet Tubman is drawing her last breath. And in late 1912, Rosa Parks is born in Tuskegee, Alabama. So there's a brief window of time when Rosa Parks, Ida B. Wells, and Harriet Tubman are alive at the same time.
Wow.
One of them is a baby. And it's going to take another 42 years before Mrs. Parks tells that bus driver in Montgomery, yeah, I'm not getting up. But it just really kind of helps us understand that this relay race we're talking about in liberation struggle, and we're talking about these black women who are involved in it, all this stuff is taking place in a small window of time. We're talking about decades, not millennia, not centuries, just decades. And as you say, the case on the Tennessee railroad car, I think, is just one of the most inspirational cases. And, you know, our creative workers are people who are filmmakers and playwrights. This is one where I tell my students all the time, one of y'all, please make a movie where Ida Wells gets on this train, says, I'm going to read my newspaper. I done bought a first class ticket. I don't like sitting in the segregated car because they smoke back there. And I just want to read my newspaper. I'm a journalist. I'm trying to read my paper. I'm trying to enjoy this small little ride. I paid my money. And when they come to put her off out of this car, because she wants to ride with dignity and she's paid her money, she bites the first guy.
Right.
Here comes the conductor, like, nah. And then when they come to forcibly eject her, she gets her feet hooked up under the seat in front of her, digs her hands in the top. And y'all, and mind you now, like Harriet Tubman, like Mrs. Parks, Ida Wells is small in stature, but like those other two, she's not to be trifled with. So eventually they have to physically evict her from this car. She turns around and sues. She gets a black lawyer. Again, she's for the race. The railroad company buys the black lawyer off. So she's got to get another lawyer. She sues again. Now, this is in the wake of the civil rights cases, what they call the civil rights cases, which in many ways attack the Reconstruction amendments of a generation before. And so by 1875, the Supreme Court decides you can have segregated rail cars, a decision that 20 years later, they're really going to bring to the height in 1896 with Plessy versus Ferguson. So, but she still, Ida Wells sues the railroad company and wins at the lowest court. Her victory is overturned on appeal, and she expresses disappointment. But to make the point, I think that you're raising, you know, who is suing for rights and protesting segregation in transportation at this time in American history, two generations before the Montgomery bus boycott, two generations before the bus boycotts in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and the birth of what many people refer to as the modern civil rights movement, is Ida Bell Wells Barnett in West Tennessee saying, I'm not going to stand for this. And before she ever sets foot in the courtroom, she balls up her fist, opens her mouth and says, I will fight you literally before I fight you in court. It's a remarkable display of courage.
Yes. And I wanted to touch really quickly on her married life. And the reason is because she takes the name Wells Barnett, right? So she doesn't even just really even give up her full name.
Right.
One. And she had a pretty, I would say, like an equal relationship to her husband. And that was unheard of back then, that they had a working relationship with her husband, and also didn't completely change her name.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, it's funny, Jenny, it's interesting. We're in 2020. So, of course, it's nothing for women and men or partners when they marry to retain their name in addition to their partner's name. It's hardly an afterthought now. But what many folks don't realize is this was a practice that black women pioneered in the 19th century. And people say, oh, I didn't know that. And all you have to do is go back and look at the most identifiable black women leaders of the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And you see they've all got their names and their husband's names. Mm. Mary McLeod Bethune, Mary Church Terrell, Ida B. Wells Barnett. It's like, so black women have been doing this long before anybody else. So yeah, I love you. I'm going to take your name and add it to my name. So it's very important to understand. But the love story, the love affair between Ferdinand Barnett of Chicago and Ida Wells is triggered by the first thing we talked about. When Ida Wells tells people they need to leave Memphis after they lynched her friend and destroyed the People's Grocery, the white people in Memphis go off, and with law enforcement, they destroy her newspaper offices. She's traveling at the time. Ida Wells is like, okay, I see you. I'm coming back to Memphis. Her friends have to prevail on her. No, you cannot move back to Memphis. So what am I going to do? Why don't you go to Chicago? And that's when you see a woman move to Chicago, and she meets Frederick Barnett, who's a lawyer, and they get married. In fact, you know, now here's she's a first-rate journalist. He's a first-rate lawyer. They're a power couple, so to speak. But the announcement of their marriage, the event of their marriage, which happened in June 1895, June 27, 1895, their announcement was announced on page one of the New York Times. So it's very interesting. Exactly. I mean, you know, they talk about what the bridesmaids had on. They talk about this power couple being married. And of course, you know, Ida Wells is a major figure in Black America. And her wedding is announced to America writ large. Because mind you now, she's already been to England. So she's an international figure. And the two of them get married. Now, not only do they get married, they have a big family. And in another kind of gangster move for her time or this, she names one of the children Ida Bell Wells. So it's like she's okay. I can't, it's not conventional to name a junior, a woman naming a daughter junior. Mm. But what does she do? She virtually creates a junior in that family that she has. And mind you, she doesn't get married till she's 33 years old. In fact, for those who are listening, I would suggest that one of the most powerful books I've ever read was edited by a sister out of West Tennessee, Miriam DaCosta Willis. She found in the archives, edited and published, The Memphis Diary of Ida B. Wells. Mm. Ida B. Wells, when she was in her early to late 20s, she was a school teacher in Memphis. And Ida Wells keeps a journal of what it means to be a black woman in the 1890s, making her way, 1880s, 1890s, making her way as a professional. She talks about everything from teaching to study. And then she really talks about relationships. She says, you know, this guy wanted to take me out, so he came calling. I went with him, but I'm afraid that he's intimidated because I know he liked the way I look. But as I was talking, it became apparent that perhaps I'm a little too educated, a little too worldly for this man, and maybe these men are not used to a woman like me. I mean, it's fascinating to see her do that. Mm. So when she found Frederick Lee Barnett, she found a man who was up to the wonderful opportunity to be a life partner with a woman of that kind of formidable intellect and drive.
Well, I want to bring her work forward to present day in terms of the anti-lynching work that she was doing. What are your thoughts on anti-lynching legislation happening today in 2020? Do you feel like it's still necessary? And just the fact that it took this long to even get anything remotely close to passing?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, of course, I'm glad that the legislation was proposed and passed. I also think that this is a political climate where it's easier to get something passed like that. And I think it speaks to a couple of underlying issues that we have to confront if we're being honest in this country. Let's, as you say, bring her work, bring Ida Wells's work forward to this moment very succinctly by saying that Ida Wells was the champion of anti-lynching work from the late 19th century up to the first third of the 20th century. And she, as I said, she participated in the founding of the MSEP. And there was a senator, Leonidas Dyer, who pushed for an anti-lynching bill that was finally introduced. It passed the House of Representatives 1922, but it died in the United States Senate because the Senate had these Southern segregationist senators who blocked every piece of anti-lynching legislation from the act that was introduced in 1922, the Dyer anti-lynching bill, all the way through the 1960s. But Ida Wells is not given the credit to this day that she deserves because in the wake of the formation of the NAACP, they took up anti-lynching as a central issue. And at the time of the work to get the Dyer anti-lynching bill passed, and in the wake of its defeat, the NAACP made anti-lynching one of its signature causes. And that cause was taken up or kind of personified in some ways by Walter White, the director of the NAACP, who took over the reins from the first black executive director, James Weldon Johnson, who had been an anti-lynching activist as well. Walter White published some very powerful books and publications around anti-lynching. Walter White, and you know, there's a reason why W.E.B. Du Bois called him White Walter, kind of derisively in some ways, but Walter White could have passed for white. And Walter White would often investigate lynchings after they had occurred. And when people would come and say, hey, there's a Negro around here asking about this lynching, only then would the people he had interviewed discover that he was black. Mm. So he showed some incredible courage. But sexism, infighting in that small group of black leadership, shut Ida Wells out of her due recognition of being the woman who in many ways lit the torch that became the anti-lynching movement. Now we fast forward over many decades of struggling for anti-lynching legislation, only to see it blocked by these segregationist senators and going forward. The main reason that anti-lynching legislation did not pass, at least the main stated reason beyond white supremacy, was that you had these fierce advocates of quote unquote states' rights. And their argument was the federal government could not interfere with the rights of states to punish people. And that that range of right to punish would include the right to punish for racial violence. At the same time, the Supreme Court is really crafting out this theory of colorblind constitutionalism to really argue that even if someone has been deprived of their life or their liberty and they are black, you've got to demonstrate that they were deprived of that because they were black, which means you've got to meet an intent standard. You almost have to call somebody a racial epithet before you lynch them. And even if you do that, there are rulings at the Supreme Court level that say, well, that was personal animus. It wasn't really racial. And that all begins to change in the 1960s, the famous so-called Mississippi burning case, United States versus Price, where you see two white civil rights workers and one black civil rights worker, the famous Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney case, where they are arrested, taken to the jail. The local deputy, Cecil Price, then lets them out of jail, but there's a commingled mob of sheriff's deputies and local citizens who then kill them. At that point, the Supreme Court says this egregious transgression is indeed state action. And because it is state action, it triggers the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution that says nobody should be deprived of life, liberty without equal due process of law or equal protection under the law. That provides a crack by which you can begin to prosecute at the federal level violence against people based on race. And that's where you begin to see some thawing in the court, in the case law. Still don't have anti-lynching legislation, though. So when you see Senator Cory Booker, Senator Kamala Harris, when you see the co-sponsors that sign on, introduce this on the Senate side and name it for Emmett Till, who, of course, is lynched in 1955 in Money, Mississippi, in August 1955. What you now see is legislation that certainly can be supported, even if it's just a symbolic kind of thing, which it absolutely is not, because lynchings are still going on in many ways, racial terror, racial violence. And for people to understand, to lynch somebody means you've committed an act of violence against someone because of the group they're from, and you've committed it with other people. But it doesn't mean that you've killed them. It means you committed this act of violence. So you don't have to die in order to have been lynched. In fact, there's some famous examples, James Cameron being one, the famous person who they hung, but he survived. But he is the person who survived. He was lynched, but he survived. At any rate, when this legislation is introduced and it's been passed by the House, anticipates being passed by the Senate, it's named for Emmett Till, but in a final irony, at least the draft of the bill that passed the House of Representatives, I hope the Senate, I guess now they just got to work it out in committee. The person who is named, the organization that is named in pioneering it is the NAACP, and the person that is named is Walter White. So we don't see Ida Wells' name. And I'm saying some congressional staffer, y'all couldn't figure out how to get Ida Bell Wells Barnett in this legislation. That she was absolutely part of the group that struggled to get passed in the 20s, by the time she passed away in the early 1930s, it still wasn't legislation. And in 2020, particularly when you've got women like Kamala Harris involved, and it shouldn't be circumscribed to women members of the national legislature, you know, it would have been nice to see Ida Wells' name in it.
We've been speaking with Associate Professor of Africana Studies and Chair of the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University, Dr. Gregory Carr, about investigative journalist, abolitionist, and suffragist, and civil rights icon, Ida B. Wells. Dr. Carr, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Always a pleasure.